The House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Wednesday, June 7th, 2017. Thank you, everybody, for being here today. We're having two informational hearings, so I want to get started right away. The first item on the agenda is House Bill 2712. It requires law enforcement agencies to adopt policies on responding to officer-involved domestic violence incidents. Representative, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Carla Peluso, representative from House District 50, the great city of Gresham. As many of you know, I spent 30 years in law enforcement, the last six as the chief of police for Gresham. Throughout my career, I've been committed to making families and communities safer. I bring that commitment to my work in the legislature. Domestic violence has been a primary concern of mine for decades and a constant priority. House Bill 2712 concerns officer-involved domestic violence. That is, when an officer is involved in domestic violence at home, whether as a victim or a perpetrator. House Bill 2712 would require all law enforcement agencies in Oregon to have a concrete policy for responding to officer-involved domestic violence and its warning signs, and would require all officers be trained on their agency policy. It would recreate a legislative task force, including law enforcement and domestic violence advocates, that would devise a policy framework that agencies could choose to adopt. If an agency would prefer to devise their own policy, they may do so, as long as it meets minimum qualifications outlined in the bill. The bill is designed to be flexible and does not assume what will work best for individual agencies. If every law enforcement agency had a clear written policy for how to respond when officers are involved in domestic violence, every officer would know without question how to respond and would respond quickly and with consistency. I see this policy as preventative. When we identify warning signs, when we address problems from the very start, we prevent senseless violence and we prevent tragedies like the one in Gresham. This is an issue that we shouldn't be keeping quiet about. Officers need a clear policy and training so they know what to do when a colleague is involved in domestic violence. I've been encouraged by broad stakeholder interest and involvement in this legislation since its conception, especially from the law enforcement community, and remain committed to seeing all Oregon law enforcement agencies adopt officer-involved domestic violence policies in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions, please?
Thank you. And if I missed this in the beginning of your testimony, I apologize. Thank you for that. Has there been any work, notwithstanding this bill, has there been any work with the law enforcement community to address some of these issues?
We have made attempts to work with the sheriffs and the chiefs through their lobbyists without much success.
Follow up. Meaning they won't talk about it or what?
They don't see it as an issue. Is my opinion.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry. Next, I'll call Jay Hoffmeister, Kelsey Hoffmeister, Joel Shapiro, and Jason Kafori, please.
Sure.
And you can speak in any order. Just be sure to try to remember to identify yourself for the record.
Okay. Well, thank you for hearing us.
Sure. And if you say your name, please.
Jay Hoffmeister.
Thank you.
This is my wife, Kelsey's mother, Katie. Some pictures of Katie and Vicky, the other victim here. Sorry, I wanted a picture of her. My daughter, Kelsey.
I guess what I want to talk about today is just a couple of things in support of House Bill 2712, which apparently is dead at this point. Bad terminology. So I'll go over quickly what happened here. 2010, February 2010, the girls wanted a night out. So they all got together and went to a restaurant in Gresham. And later that night, one of the ladies' husband, Officer Gron from Clackamas County, hunted him down, found him at the restaurant in Gresham, and came in, grabbed his wife, drug her outside, shot and killed her in a parking lot, came back in, found Katie and Vicky, and shot them point blank, and then went back out to the parking lot where his wife was and shot himself. So after investigation and looking into the whole case, it was found that Jeff was involved in domestic violence with family and friends. So with more investigation, we found out that Clackamas County knew of the domestic violence. In other words, at least two family members and two friends of family had called and realized that Jeff there was some domestic violence involved at the home, at the Grand home. So so more investigation uncovered that this family member and another friend who was law enforcement in a different county had called Clackamas County and identified this as domestic violence and wanted the county to do something about it. So what the county chose to do was nothing. We had I'm losing it here.
My name is Kelsey Hoffmeister. Basically, after the investigation was done, or after the reports were made, there was an investigation done by the city of Portland, and they went back to the Clackamas County, and Clackamas County decided to do nothing about it. That's kind of the more backstory of it. If they would have done something about it, if this bill was in place, I don't think we would be here today. My mom would be alive. The other families would be alive.
So I think what we're here to tell you is more than one other law enforcement agency knew of the possible or of the abuse that Jeff was doing, was involved in. And although they suggested to the county sheriff that they do something, and in one instance, the Portland police actually called or suggested they get the district attorney of Clackamas County involved, which the sheriff's department did not, chose not to. So I think what we're saying here is, if you kind of get the story, House Bill 2712, or a domestic officer-involved domestic violence bill, would have prevented something like this happening. And what we're here for, other than to tell our story, is to hopefully prevent something like this ever happening again. I think the efforts of Representative Peluso, when she was talking about that bill here, when I was sitting and listening to it, I think we all realized, I think Avon saw you, you know, roll your eyes a little bit. What's preventing us from passing a bill like this? Why don't we have something like this? This is a common sense bill, and I don't know what the pushback is. I don't know what the opposition has suggested to you people, but I think, you know, this is a bill that will help agencies help themselves. Now, if there's a other issues that we're not involved in, I'd surely like to hear them, and maybe through Carla Peluso's office, we could work with them. But House Bill 2712 like this was definitely something we could use to prevent something like this to happen again. And we ask your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kafouri?
Yeah, thank you. I'm Jason Kafouri. I'm an attorney at law firm of Kafouri and McDougall, and I represented the Hoffmeisters in their civil action against Clackamas County Sheriff's Department. We're not here today to badmouth the Clackamas County Sheriff's Department, even though they did an absolutely horrible job of dealing with the Jeffrey Grand situation. We would like to take this tragedy and be able to save lives. Let's start with the problem. Domestic violence amongst police officers is 2 to 4 times higher than in the general population. I brought you an article from The Atlantic, a big in-depth article. It's higher than in the NFL. Domestic violence amongst police officers is higher than amongst the National Football League. So the problem is real. We know it's documented. So the question is, what are we going to do about it as a community and society? Well, the state of Washington, our neighbors, had a similar tragedy back in early 2000s. Chief of a police, Chief Brain, murdered his wife, and then I believe murdered himself, right? And similar situation. There was evidence that they could have done something to help the chief, and they didn't. Well, you know what the state of Washington did? They didn't sit around and wait for years to do something. That very next legislative cycle, they built a coalition of groups, domestic violence groups, and they passed what is now the best bill in the entire country involving domestic violence. It is a model, in fact, for the country. That they passed it in 2004. They had the governor behind it. And what that bill requires is that once an officer has an allegation of domestic violence, they must be taken off duty, surrender their firearm, and an investigation is required to be done by an outside agency. Now, in this bill that we're proposing here, we're not even coming up with the framework here. We're just trying to start the process, and we came up with the idea of having DPSST, since they certify police officers, come up with that model plan, and we'd like to work together with them to do that. But the state of Washington did it right. They created a model. This is not a problem that just exists within our region. This is a national problem. And I brought in the International Association of Police Chiefs have come up with a model bill. In fact, that's what BRAME bill was based on, was what the International Association of Police Chiefs came up with. So this is a problem that police chiefs around the country understand. They want to do something about. But frankly, the police unions and their lobby is pretty strong. And that's why, you know, we started this process 2 years ago after the civil case resolved, to try to get something done here at the legislature to fix the problem. We talked to the various entities representing the police unions and the police chiefs. They had some, you know, general agreement that it's a problem. But as we've seen, nothing has changed. Still to this day, Clackamas County Sheriff's Department has not adopted a formal plan that is in writing of how to deal with allegations of domestic violence. I mean, the Grand situation happened 7 years ago, 2010, and nothing has changed. So the reality is that, and they point out a couple of the egregious facts in the Grand investigation. The one really serious thing that happened, I mean, there was a whole bunch of serious things, but Clackamas County Sheriff's Internal Affairs, the head of Internal Affairs, met with the Portland Police to start a domestic violence allegation. The Portland Police had put together 30 pages of allegations, very detailed, from Charlotte Grand's sister and from some of the other family members. And it was, you know, I won't even go into all the details of it, but it was really ugly stuff, and it was documented. And the Portland Police told the Clackamas County Sheriff's Internal Affairs head, Phelan. They said to Phelan, what we do in Portland is we work with the district attorney while we're developing probable cause for domestic violence. And there's a memo that was written after the death where Sergeant Bonson of the Portland Police said, Phelan said not once but twice, no, don't do that here. Don't bring in the Clackamas County district attorney. That was as big of a smoking gun as you could have, that Clackamas County Sheriff's Department was not taking these allegations seriously. And as we've learned, when you enable someone who does domestic violence, when you turn the other cheek and don't do anything about it, it ratchets up. It's the same problem we've seen over and over again throughout history. And that's what happened in this terrible tragedy, and these family members will have to live with that tragedy for the rest of their lives. What I would like to work here with the legislature on is to get some people, not just Representative Peluso, who are passionate about this, who want to help us next session. I realize we're not going to be able to get something done this session, but I think we need to put together a bigger team of people to work on this, both House and Senate, to make their tragedy and all the other families that have lost loved ones something that we can prevent down the road by coming up with this model plan so that when there's an allegation of domestic violence, there are serious repercussions, and that person who's doing it, the perpetrator, knows that their police force has an outside entity that's going to investigate. I think it will save a lot of lives, and the power is obviously in your hands. As we've seen, the police chiefs around the state have not implemented model policies on their own. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Joel? For the record, I'm Joel Shapiro. I'm going to keep this pretty brief. I'm here primarily to answer questions. I've been working with the family on this policy issue. I first started working on domestic violence in 1999 when I was a law student and came down here. My first time testifying in front of this body was that session. And we passed a law to create a hearsay exception for domestic violence, which I had crafted working with law enforcement folks and one of my law professors, Doug Ballouf, and that became law, and there are now at least 10 states that have a similar law. So domestic violence policy evolves over time, and I think that officer-involved domestic violence is one of the issues where we have had an opportunity to see what works, to learn from it, and now it's time for Oregon to implement that policy. What this bill would do is look forward, and as Jay has said many times when we've come and met with folks here, and we've had a chance to meet with most of the members of the committee, this is about being proactive, not reactive. They don't have anything to gain from this bill. They've already gone through their tragedy. They want to prevent this from happening. This is not about looking backwards and pointing fingers and blaming anybody for anything that's happened. This is about how can we make Oregon a safer place for victims of domestic violence when the perpetrator has a badge and a gun and a lot of authority and knows how the system works. And, you know, just quite frankly, it can't be voluntary. This needs to be a statewide law where every law enforcement agency has a written policy so that they can follow those protocols when an allegation occurs. It's pretty simple. This bill would set that policy-making authority with DPSST, which I think is a very reasonable and appropriate place for that to happen. So originally, there was a bill that was more prescriptive. Law enforcement said that's a problem. Representative Peluso has done just amazing work, and I really want to thank her. I should have started with that. Thank you to Representative Peluso for leading this effort, and thank you to the members of the committee for your interest in this issue. I hope we can go forward and come up with a solution. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Barker. This is actually more of a question for you. I was surprised to hear law enforcement categorized as unresponsive to this bill. And
I'm going to have somebody come up and talk.
So there is, okay, good. Thank you.
I have the same
okay.
question. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. And I'll call Kevin Campbell, please.
And I will leave just for the record. There's other areas, other sections of the country, like the city of Pittsburgh and Tennessee, that have adopted some measures. So I'm going to leave those with you guys for the record.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the committee. I deeply appreciate the chance to testify briefly. My name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I was not able to get to the hearing right at the beginning, but I understand there was a suggestion that the police chiefs and sheriffs were not being responsive on this issue, which is trying to find the right word to respond to that. I actually take this issue and my part in making sure our associations move forward deliberatively, very personally. So a suggestion that we were not responsive is deeply disappointing to me. On the record, I think it's posted. We spent hundreds of hours creating a policy framework. It is our preferred way of implementing policies around the state, and the reason for that is that in our roughly 180 police departments in the state, we have departments with several hundred officers. We have 30 agencies that have under five officers, and legislation is often the most difficult way to implement policy because those agencies have to implement things differently based on their resources, their community needs. Some have to do things in partnerships where other can do them with internally. And so what we tried to do and what we spent hundreds of hours doing was creating this policy framework. It's a policy framework that really went through best practice in this area in detail. So if you see it, it's not a small document. We not only created it, then we trained to it. We not only trained to it, we worked to make sure that agencies had the policies in place. I can tell you today, every sheriff's office in the state has this policy. I'm finishing today just to make sure, but I know that of the just around 120, there's over 100 agencies that have this in place. And Clackamas County was one of the leaders in moving forward with this. They, after all, were in the midst of this tragedy and really had to figure out what could we have done differently. Now, I know there's been characterizations about how they responded, but I'll tell you this. I was told today, well, they don't have a policy. That's not true. I said, was the sheriff ever asked? No. Well, that's unfair, and it's not true. And so I'm deeply disappointed about that characterization. If you read the introduction to the policy framework, you'll see that it's signed by both of our presidents of our association. It is something we've embraced completely. We've also done training for our detectives statewide. At the recent Child Abuse Summit, we brought an expert in to train specifically to this. We're in the process. We already got a grant, and we have a training committee dedicated just to officer-involved domestic violence that is right now scheduling additional trainings, and they're in the process of developing specific video training so that every agency in the state has access to training around the importance of officer-involved domestic violence. If you had the chance to read the President's 21st Century Policing Report that was developed under President Obama, then you'll know there were seven pillars identified in that particular document. They dealt with a wide range of policing challenges. The first pillar being, how does law enforcement engage communities more effectively, thoughtfully, so that we have less tension based on the approach that law enforcement uses in communities? That pillar, along with the seventh pillar, are the two most important. The seventh pillar is officer wellness. And I think I probably, in this committee before, mentioned that the challenges for police officers are immense. Unlike the military that deploys for periods of time and then is not deployed, law enforcement officers, because of the work they do, are really deployed at all times. The pressure, the stress, the things they see and have to deal with and have in their memories that don't go away are things that police agencies have to be better at dealing with. And this is a big emphasis within the Chiefs and Sheriffs Association. How do we keep officers well for a lifetime? If you look at our decertification numbers in the state, because you know Oregon is aggressive at making sure that officers who should not be in law enforcement don't remain there, we see that officers begin to burn out and they do things that compromise their careers. It's all connected to officer wellness. And I mentioned before, one of the challenges we have in the state, and it's something we're going to have to address, is we have some of the lowest patrol strength in the state in anywhere in the nation. And I think I mentioned that the Oregon State Police troopers are 48th out of 49 states in terms of their patrol strength per 100,000, and that our city and county police are at the same range, at the bottom of the United States in terms of officers per 1,000. We have officers stretched thin, They don't have backup. They're being asked to do more and more to interact with society's greatest needs, whether it's mental health or it's domestic violence or other issues. And I know I'm talking on and on, so forgive me. But I do want to be clear. The chiefs and sheriffs have not only engaged in a good faith process to address the concerns that were raised in this bill, I believe firmly and can stand here and say without question, we have gone above and beyond to ensure our agencies are actually responsive to this tragic, terrible incident, and to make sure it does not happen again in other departments. It is our leaders' great fear that they are going to have officers that are going to be in situations like this. It's a tragedy. Tragedy for families, for the officer, for the department, for the community, for everybody. And I'm just here to say we are committed to address this issue. We have worked hard to address this issue. We have plans to continue to address this issue, and we will be engaged in the future to ensure that we stay consistent with it. Forgive me for being so direct, but I am disappointed today at what I heard. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I am glad to answer any questions. Again, forgive me for being so
direct. We have a brief time for any questions, but we have another.
Yes, I'm sorry. I apologize. So, yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I look at your officer-involved domestic violence policy framework, 27-page document, and then I've also been looking at Washington State's I don't think I'm looking at exactly their laws. It was printed, but on their training website. I see a lot of similar language, So briefly, Kevin, if you can, talk to us about how closely, if at all, you've modeled yourself out of modeled yourself after Washington, if you're moving in that direction. Talk to me briefly.
I need to start another hearing just a few minutes, but please go
ahead. Okay, Chair Barker and Representative Springer. The answer is we looked at numerous policies from around the United States. Washington was one of them, to make sure that we really were in front of best practice, which changes regularly in policing based on research and other factors. And that's why we tend to not want to put it in legislation where it becomes difficult to move and change. And so we looked at a number of them. And so it was a very involved process.
Okay, thank you. Okay, real quick, please.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell, and thank you so much to the family and to Representative Peluso and to the advocates for being here. I was a Clackamas County Commissioner at the time of the incident that you describe, and I know that we had passionate conversations between the Board of Commissioners and Sheriff Roberts and his team around that time, and I have worked really hard on domestic violence prevention issues, and I'm going to continue to work hard on it, but I want to say just out of respect for Sheriff Roberts, that I do believe personally, as a very strong advocate for survivors and for safety, that the Clackamas County team has worked really hard in response and developed a lot of framework and pro safety response steps within the county as a result. And I salute and support the idea of working harder to do good work in the state. But I just want to be really clear that I think that in Clackamas, they actually have done a lot of work to try to address the issue. So, but thank you all for being here, and I know it's exceptionally painful.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you just for a second, because I don't want to short the other people, we only have two brief periods today.
Again, Carla Peluso, House District 50. So, for the record, I support the sheriffs and the chiefs, and I have forever. I am a retired cop. I was a chief. The one thing that resonated with the policy that was being presented to us was that there was nothing concrete that required anything. It suggested things. It said these were things to do, but it put no requirement on an action item. Okay. That was the biggest frustration in trying to get our communications across. Again, I respect Kevin Campbell. I always have. I respect our chiefs and sheriffs. Like I said, I was one. And so I just wanted to make that clear. And if under the passion of my opening statement, perhaps reflected that not in the best way, but the whole point was that there were times when not every chief and every sheriff challenged us, but were there some challenges that weren't justified from my perspective.
Okay, thank you very much, Representative. Okay, I close the public hearing on, the informational hearing on House Bill 2712 and open a informational hearing on Senate Bill 842 and call Senator Gelser, please. I apologize for the restricting the time, but we have to be back on the floor today at 2 o'clock is the reason for that.
All right, great. Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'll be brief because there are others here that can speak much better than I. What we want to talk to you about today is the availability of... Oh, sorry. My name is Sarah Gelser. I am the state senator from Corvallis and Albany. And Senate Bill 842 is about ensuring that victims of rape and sexual assault have access to the medical care that they need in a place that is close to them at the time that they need it. We've got Brenda Tracy and some other folks here who will tell you why this is important, and it's something I hope we can continue working on in future sessions. I'd like to really thank Representative Stark, who kind of dove in on this issue with me this session, and hopefully we can get further next session.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I'll call, Jacqueline Swanson, Brenda Tracy, Jessica Garcia, and Elizabeth Garcia, and we'll try to get Diane in at the end here.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Jacqueline Swanson, and I'm an attorney from Portland, Oregon. At the outset, I'd like to express my gratitude to you all for holding this informational hearing today and to Senator Gelser and Representative Stark and their efforts to work on this issue over the session. To briefly summarize, SB 842 would have amended ORS Chapter 441 to require any hospital with an ER to perform a sexual assault medical assessment and collect a sexual assault forensic exam or a rape kit upon request by a victim. The bill would have also required hospitals to establish protocols in compliance with the provisions of Melissa's Law, which was passed last session, and also to retain rape kits for at least 60 days in order to allow law enforcement officers adequate time to come and pick up the kit. Although this retention issue is, of course, extraordinarily important, and I and others here today would be happy to talk about it more at your request, the primary reason we are here is to facilitate an on-the-record discussion about victims' access to sexual assault forensic exams, especially those in rural counties. As Jessica and Brenda are going to discuss shortly, survivors in Oregon's rural counties are being turned away at hospitals and made to drive hours at their expense simply to obtain a rape kit from a qualified medical provider. This is ostensibly the result of the unavailability of sane nurses and inconsistent protocols for the administration of rape kits within these counties. This is occurring despite the fact that each county is required to have at least one sane nurse available to serve on their sexual assault response team pursuant to ORS 147-401. Unfortunately, although each hospital that provides sexual assault medical exams is required to adopt policies for treatment and referral, there's no law that requires hospitals to actually provide those exams. This is the gap that SB 842 would have filled, and which currently is the main reason for our concern. For rural areas in Oregon and nationwide, the need for trained examiners outpaces their availability, and that means rape victims aren't getting treated with the urgency and attention that they deserve. In March of 2016, the Government Accountability Office issued a report on training, funding, and availability of forensic examiners following a survey of our state, as well as five others, including Colorado, Florida, Massachusetts, Nebraska, and Wisconsin. I have a copy of this report for you for the record, but in sum, the GAO identified major gaps in access to sexual assault examinations at rural hospitals in Oregon and found that the number of examiners available does not meet the need for the exams within our state. And even among those facilities that actually have examiners available, the number available varies widely, and there are not enough examiners to provide 24-hour coverage 7 days a week. This has been borne out by other investigations into this issue. For example, a 2014 article by the Daily Historian, which I also have here for you for the record, noted that despite the fact that Oregon is one of only seven states to offer state-level SANE certification, There are 14 counties, including Columbia, Douglas, Josephine, Umatilla, and Polk, that didn't even have a SART, or a sane nurse examiner. And as a consequence, victims, such as the 10-year-old who's referenced in this Daily Historian article, are made to travel long distances simply to be seen by a trained provider. This is problematic for a whole host of reasons, as timeliness is not only critical for evidence preservation, but also the comfort of the victim, since they're advised not to eat, drink, or bathe between the time of the assault and the examination. Equally important, however, is the fact that many victims who are referred elsewhere don't follow through and thus never receive an exam. To make matters worse, if a victim doesn't want to shoulder the burden and expense of traveling hours to endure what is unquestionably an intrusive and intrinsically traumatic exam, that fact may be used against her in a criminal investigation or criminal proceeding. Or at the very least, it will cause prosecutors to miss out on potentially important and probative DNA evidence. The GAA report also identifies a number of other problems. I won't get into all of them here, but it does address one thing, which involves a lack of support from hospitals. Hospitals may be reluctant to support training programs and examiners due to facially low numbers of reported sexual assault cases in the county each year. So as a result, medical professionals are often made to cover the costs of their examiner training courses themselves or face lost wages associated with attending training. It also appears that some hospitals do not pay examiners to be on call, although in other instances, they may pay on-call sexual assault nurse examiners less than other on-call medical professionals. We did reach out to the Sexual Assault Task Force in advance of this hearing, and their representatives couldn't be here today, but they do share our concern with this lack of access to care in rural and frontier counties, and are and have been committed to addressing these issues. So although SB 842 didn't move forward this session, it's our hope that we can work together, both in the interim and perhaps next session, to identify these outstanding questions, concerns, possible solutions, and chart a path forward to providing sexual assault survivors within our state the safe, steady support which they deserve and which we are empowered to provide them. Thank you very much, and I welcome any opportunity for questions you may have.
Okay, thank you. Please proceed, and we'll see if we have questions. We have time.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair. Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Jessica Garcia, and I am a resident of Curry County. SB 842, I was very saddened that it died. I am a rape survivor 3 years ago, and this bill impacts me greatly. So for me, bear with me, I'm a little nervous and read off of this. SB 842 is simply common sense. I feel no survivor should have to leave their hospital that has an emergency department to drive hours away. For me, I had to cross state lines because I didn't want to drive 3.5 hours away. Countless stories of survivors will not continue in the reporting process when they find out they will be transported in the back of a police car, alone and hours away. Curry County, a mother, wife, established community member, wants to discreetly report. She can't because her family would know if she was gone to another county that made her drive 3 hours one way, 3 hours back, not including the time spent there with the officer and SANE nurses. Curry County, again, no SANE nurse. In the last 6 months in Curry County, 6 rapes were reported. In the last 10 years, 6 to 8, on the average 6 to 8 are reported, but out of all of those, not everyone wants to travel again 3 to 6 hours round trip. So if you take a look at that, that's 60 to 80 women in 10 years, and most of them don't want to travel. So, again, Clackamas County, they have a SANE nurse, but a 15-year-old girl was raped, she reported, and because they don't have a SANE nurse that did a juvenile SANE nurse exam, she had to travel in the middle of the night with her mother, who spoke Spanish only and not English. She was scared, and she was feeling like she was the one in trouble in the back of a patrol car. caged in the middle of the night. Coos County, they do have a sane nurse. And please forgive me, I'm going to be kind of blunt about this one. Just imagine you're a young woman on a Friday night, was raped, goes to the hospital to report. There is no sane nurse on duty. They tell you to go home, come back on Monday, but please don't wash. What that really means, and again, excuse me, is do not wash your rapist semen out of your vagina and wait 2.5 days. I don't think that's okay. That is not okay. And I know that everyone that has a heart and has sympathy and has kids, has a mother, anyone would not want this to happen to them. And again, excuse me for being so blunt. In Oregon, there are 15 counties as of 2014 that do not have certified nurses. That's 513,270 Oregonians that are without a sane nurse and will need to travel to a different county. To give you an idea of a population in a county, Curry County is only 22,600 of those Oregonians. And if you look around, one out of three women will or have been sexually assaulted. One out of six men will or have been sexually assaulted in their lifetime. So if you live in Clatsop, Columbia, Sherman, Gilman, Morrow, Umatilla, Wallowa, Grant, Wheeler, Polk, Douglas, Curry, Josephine, Lake, or Harney County, I'm sorry to tell you, but you are not in the right geographic location to receive help. I am a rape survivor. I'm a mother. And no sane nurse was there for me. So, like I said, I had to travel across state lines. I'm an Oregonian. Why should I have to travel to California? I should be able to travel to my hospital with an emergency department and not be refused. I don't feel and I know that rape victims should not be refused. That is not okay. So, because we don't have the training, because our hospital did not want to train a sane nurse in the last 10 years, I ended up needed extra photos taken of my naked body. So I get to go, not to a hospital, I get to go to our dilapidated courthouse downstairs in a basement with an officer's wife who happens to be a parole officer to take pictures of my strangled neck, my bitten back, my torn areola, my bruised privates in a basement. And that is not okay. And it does not just happen to an adult. It happens to young people too. It does not matter. There is no discrimination in that. So, again, I want to end this by saying I am a survivor, and this is not okay. And I thank you, Chair Barker, and the members of this committee for being patient with me. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you for your time. Your testimony is very important, and we appreciate you having it. I'm sorry you have to go through it all again. Okay, please.
Hello, Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Elizabeth Garcia, and I'm 13 years old, and I am from Curry County. My mother is Jessica Garcia, a survivor. My mom has inspired me to speak today because I know many survivors won't or can't speak for themselves. SB 842 is important to me because I don't want any survivors to have to travel out of their county or hours away from home. To see a friend or family member being taken away to a different county when the county they live in has a hospital and emergency room, can't use it for some of its purposes. isn't a hospital used to treat patients after an injury? Hospitals are supposed to help you after something bad has happened. That's what we have known ever since we were growing up. But some county hospitals can't do their job. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for coming and testifying.
Hello, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Brenda Tracy. I'm just moved and inspired by these two brave women. Obviously, I think you understand that this is an issue, that in Oregon, unfortunately, access to a sane nurse depends on geography, which is unacceptable. In my own case, this is especially important to me because after my gang rape, in which I was assaulted for 6 hours by 4 men, I was convinced by my mother and a woman at the Women's Crisis Center to go to my local hospital in Salem, here in Salem, to get a rape kit done. And on the way to the hospital, I had decided that I was going to kill myself. And I was very much at peace with that decision because the pain I was enduring was far worse. And the idea of dying felt good. But once I got to the hospital, I decided that I would complete the rape kit, and then after that, I would kill myself. But it was my sane nurse who saved my life. It was the compassion and the empathy that she showed me that not only inspired me to live, but to become a nurse myself. And I started school 2 months later. I have been a registered nurse for 14 years. That angel is Janine Aguilar. She is still at Salem Hospital today. I was reunited with her 16 years after my rape, and I was able to thank her for saving my life. It's not okay that women can't get a rape kit, or men, or children in our state. We have been metaphorically patting ourselves on each other's backs over Melissa's Law, but there are people who are not benefiting. And what good is a law if there's not equal protection for all Oregonians? And I think that we should not rest until all Oregonians are protected equally under our law. I was sad that SB 842 did not move forward. I serve on the governor's task force regarding Melissa's Law. I would like us to either appoint that task force to address this issue, create a work group, talk about this in the interim, figure out what we need to do. Because one of the biggest problems is that because we have this issue, and because so many people cannot have access to care, victims know I'm going to have to drive 3 hours, so I'm just not going to report. We're not helping to incentivize anyone to report. And the women that are coming forward are having horrible experiences, and they may be sharing those experiences with other people. So we're really not making any forward progress if this continues. And that's what we want. We want to make forward progress. We want to start having victims come forward, accessing medical care, prosecuting. None of that is going to happen if we are in this state. So I thank you for having all of us today, and thank you to both of you for being here today.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Sorry I had to do that. And we'll have time then to call up Diane Branson then too, please.
Mr. Chair, while you're doing that, I need to say this issue ought to be in the Health Committee as well, because I think we've dealt with it very clearly in that committee.
That's a very good point. Thank you. We'll move to the Health Committee maybe, possibly, for the next session, since it has to do with the hospitals. And we are a little limited for time. We have to be back on the floor here.
No, I totally understand. In fact, I didn't think we were going to have time to get this far. So, Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Denise Foles, and I'm Government Relations with Salem Health. And I have with us this afternoon Diane Branson, who is our SANE nurse coordinator at Salem Health and also serves in some variety of capacities, and I'll allow her to introduce herself and share some other thoughts. So,
is it safe to assume SANE is sexual abuse nurse examiner?
Close. Sexual assault nurse examiner. Yeah. So thank you for being here, and thank the people who spoke before me for their story, because their stories are horrible and not what any of us want to have happen to anyone. And I totally agree with their concerns. I am a sexual assault nurse examiner. I have been since 2010, and I coordinate the program at Salem Hospital. This House bill has great intentions, and I really like it. I'm just not sure how we can implement that across our state in some areas. The Oregon Board of Nursing has very strict rules on what nurses can do in their scope of practice. They have guidelines and an algorithm they have developed that says what you have to be able to prove competency in to do this exam. It's not something that just any nurse can do. My first sexual assault was before that Nurse Practice Act. Part of it was written, and I was handed a kit and said, you need to go do this exam on this woman. She was raped. And I said, I've never done this before. And they said, just read the directions. You can do it. That's not the care you want your family member to have. You want someone who has been trained. I've had 40 hours of classroom training along with hundreds of hours of continuing education to do these exams so that I know what to look for, so that I can perform a speculum exam on a woman who's been, you know, sexually assaulted and hurt, and do it carefully and competently and get the evidence collected needed. I know how to process that evidence, how to package it, how to store it, and how to take care of it. I know what medications this woman or child or male needs to prevent sexually transmitted infections. I know what to give them to prevent pregnancy if that's their wish. I know who might need protection to not get HIV from this assault. And in the rural areas, those nurses don't get enough experience. If you have one exam a year, how can you be competent? The physicians can do this exam, yes. But it's 4 to 6 hours. If that's your little emergency room and you have one doctor, they're going to leave you multiple times to go take care of that stroke patient, that heart attack, whatever. I want a SANE nurse in every hospital. I want our hospital to have a SANE nurse there 24 hours, and we don't. We have somebody on call, but we don't have a nurse in the building. I'd love to work together with everybody and make this work for everyone, because it's not right that you have to drive 3 to 6 hours. No. It's not right that you have to leave your hospital. It's not right that you're told you can't eat or drink, yet those are all the things that will help in the evidence collection and the prosecution of the person that did this to you. I just think we need to work in a way to make it feasible for everyone, and so that the women in the rural counties and the men and the children all get the same best practice care, which is hard to do, and I understand that the logistics are really daunting, but I think we've got to work on a way to get that so that everybody can have good care, because would you really want this exam done by someone who has done one exam in the last 2 years? Are they going to see the injuries? Are they going to know what to document? Are they going to know what evidence to collect? Are they going to know what medication to give you so you don't get AIDS, so you don't get gonorrhea or syphilis or chlamydia, or so you don't get pregnant? This is not what you would want for your wife, your child, your son, your daughter, yourself. So, and I have huge concerns on the 60-day storage requirement, just because I don't understand it, but that's another story. I don't get 60 days in 7 days.
Yeah. Quick question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Did anybody approach you that was crafting this bill to get your ideas for it? Okay. No. Do you know of anybody as they were crafting this bill that approached the hospital association?
I can't really speak for the hospital association. I can only speak for Salem Health. So,
okay,
I had heard briefly of the bill, but I wasn't.
And I believe Representative Greenlick's suggestion or request makes a lot more sense. That needs to be in the health committee. This is more of a hospital issue than a. You know, we do the more the criminal civil law. There clearly needs to be something done, but it would make sense to move it there. We'd be glad to help if we could be an adjunct to that. But I think that's where probably in the next session that ought to.
I think it makes a lot of sense. There are standards for emergency rooms that are sometimes hard to meet, but they still standards, and I think we need to make sure that we have those standards in a way that are reasonable, and that the nursing board can deal with this in terms of the scope of practice.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you, everybody, for your testimony. I need to adjourn the meeting today so we can get back over to the other side. Thank you. adjourn the meeting today so we can get back over to the other side. Thank you. I need